Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Bhutaṃ dhammaṃ saṅkhaṃ namassāmi. At the Bhikkhus Patimokkha meeting this morning, I was invited to give some account of my time away in Thailand. During the winter retreat, I went to Thailand for 3 months. So I find it difficult to believe that 2 weeks ago, I was in Bangkok, and now I'm here. So when I was given the prospect of trying to recall all the events, the significant events of my journey around Thailand, for it was something of a tour. My immediate response was, well, how much time do we have, and how much would you like to hear? I feel I could fill the best part of an hour. I was encouraged to keep a journal. But I'm still filling in the details, and although I did record where we went, I know where I went, but sometimes I got the names wrong, or the addresses don't match up with Google Maps, so I can't find them on the map yet. But I'll get the details sorted when Ajahn Ratanavana gets back. For me, many wonderful things came out of my adventure to Asia. This was my first trip, my first experience of Thailand, even though I've been ordained for more than 20 years. People think, you left it rather late, haven't you? Or why, why is it you hadn't been earlier? I was just trying to recollect what conditions brought about this particular trip in the first place. It's a combination of we had Lumpur Sopon staying here for the Vassa last year. And I remember he made a hint before he left. He made a hint to me while I was sitting in the reception room where the senior monks sit. And he was quite indirect, but I thought, very, very clever way of putting a hint. He asked me if I could eat sticky rice. And my immediate response was, oh, no, I don't think so. that the question stayed with me. Well, could I eat sticky rice? Of course, the implication is, wouldn't you like to come and visit me in Thailand? That's what he was saying. He was hinting. And eat sticky rice. So I developed a taste for sticky rice. One of my fears, one of my great anticipations was, well, would I be able to manage the food? I'm pleased to say the food was very, very tame, very sensible. I'd heard these stories of these incredibly hot, spicy dishes that might be in the food line. But actually, after having been to Thailand, I know now that this is just a speciality of Wat Pha Phong. So, beware. I couldn't have gone on this venture without the cooperation and willingness of Ajahn Ratanavano, because the winter here had been so severe. He'd already determined to get away for the last winter that just passed, and it was then I thought, well, this could be an opportunity for me. So I very I put it very gently, asked Ajahn Ratanavano if he would be at all interested in taking me with him. Because for the past 2 or 3 years, maybe both he and Ajahn Vajira thought it'd be a good idea if I had spent some time in Thailand. But interestingly, though, if I'd accepted that suggestion 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, my experience of Thailand would have been fairly limited to just Wat Banana Chat and Wat Pha Phong, maybe. But on this occasion, I had the benefit of travelling pretty well the full scope of Thailand, although we hadn't any set plan. The only plans that were reasonably certain was arriving at Bangkok Airport and departure. So one of the first places we visited was Lumpur Sopot's place, Bung Sansuk Korat. And he was my sponsor for the visa. And Lumpur Sopot, Ajahn Sopot, he's visited Amaravati before. I've met him on 2 occasions. I seem to remember he came to visit us down in Devon in 2005. And Ajahn Sopot, Ajahn Ratanavana regards Ajahn Sopot as his teacher. So there were a few monasteries that we'd got on a sort of penciled down on our list. We were hoping to get to Chiang Mai, but really, where we went depended on the certain senior monks being present in their monasteries, and so we had to move as the conditions were favourable. We could only go where, if the senior monks were there. So I think it's important for me to acknowledge the input and energy, persistence that Ajahn Ratnavano put into making this whole experience a success for me, because he's got this amazing piece of technology called the iPad, and he. For most of the time, I was blissfully unaware just how much juggling of possibilities that he had to work with, finding out who was in their monasteries and what places were available for us to go to in the next few days or the next week. So he did much, he has very good communication skills, and he was the one who provided all the contacts, not just for the monasteries to go to, but also practical things like how we were going to get there. And so I also need to express gratitude and appreciation for the numerous long journeys provided by his brother. I could sit here and just go through like a whole list of the monasteries we went to and what happened at each place, but I thought I might just start with recollecting a few sort of anecdotes about, you know, what happens when someone from England finds himself in an unknown, unfamiliar environment. Of course, I've been warned of the snakes, and to take a torch with me, and certain precautions, don't pick up things unless you know what it is. And in short, be attentive to what you're doing. One evening, I'd made the mistake of leaving my light on in my kuti. And at Bung Latiwan, Lumpur Sopon's monastery, the first night. Now, in the evenings in Thailand, for those of you who haven't experienced the end of the day in Thailand, the light fails very quickly. So you need to plan ahead in anticipation of the need of a torch. So I'd left the light on my kuti, and then it got dark. And even though we have these mosquito meshes on the windows, somehow a whole swarm of flies had got in. So when I opened the door, it was like maybe a third serverless seating. It was just one mass of winged insects. And I thought, oh no, is this what I have to put up with every evening? It was my first evening at the monastery. I thought, everything was fine up to now. So is this what I had to put up with, this great swarm? I just couldn't believe it. So in a state of panic, I sort of stumbled through the darkness to Ajahn Ratnamana's kuti, sort of, call out. So if he can sense I'm in a state of dismay, and I'm just a little surprised at his very, very cool attitude. He says, well, let's just go for a walk around the lake. I thought, oh, well, that seems a good idea. So we go for a walk around the lake, and around the, actually on the edge of this monastery, there's water all the way round, so it's more like a moat than a lake. Anyway, there is a circular path, and so we spend 20 minutes just enjoying the view of the stars on a clear sky. And another feature I hadn't seen before was the fireflies. So I was treated to a very entertaining spectacle of fireflies flitting across the lake, and the beauty of the night sky and the stars. So this took my mind off this apparent crisis. And so by the time I got back to my kuti in my room, there were no flies. The problem, the phenomenon had moved on and changed into something else. What it was actually was just a swarm of flying ants that happens from time to time. These flying ants, they lose their wings very quickly. So it was just this mass of wings on the floor and the remaining insects just running off into the corners. And it's like the problem is past. So that was a learning experience for me, just to stay open to the unexpected. But it did seem a very real sort of daunting prospect, thinking, is this what I have to put up with every evening? It's only something that happened occasionally. Ajahn Suphot's monastery is very close to the Air Force base, and so this was my first dharana in Thailand, my first experience of having sitting in the food sala. Say it's at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the lay people are arriving, and the food is being offered on the servery. And I have a note in my diary that there's a fighting cock in the sala strutting around, and there were cats begging for food scraps. So I have this almost a very strong perception of a sort of satsanya of farmyard feeling, like this, to keep cocks and cats and dogs is a feature of most monasteries, at least cats and dogs. That's something, a hazard we all have to tolerate. because there are so many stray pets in Thailand, and because there is so much kindness and compassion for life of any form, then dogs and cats tend to accumulate because we have so much food left over. We have so much to share. There is a downside to that. One day, one of the dogs decided to eat my left shoe. Fortunately, I wasn't wearing it at the time. I was quite interested in what was going on because I didn't seem to be too concerned. I get very uppity when anything of mine gets broken or eaten, but I seem to just take this quite calmly somehow. I think just the novelty of the whole experience was more interesting to me than the getting lost in the particulars of my own possessions. What I noticed was that there were many monasteries in Thailand where there's only two or three monks. It's easy for us as monks to, when we think of Thailand or we think of Wat Phanarchat and Wat Pha Phong, but there's also the maybe 200 other branch monasteries. Many of these have just a few monks. Difficult for us to appreciate that. Some of these monasteries are quite large. So the main feature of the day is the Pindapat. That's a custom, a practice we don't have the opportunity so much to observe here. But if you go to Thailand as a monastic, then it's expected that one's available to go take the bowl and robe and walk barefoot. Well, maybe not always the whole distance barefoot, but be seen walking barefoot in the village. And then very often one would leave the monastery before it's quite light. So then I had to get accustomed to the experience and practice of wearing the both robes. I thought, this is just some sort of practice to make our lives a bit more awkward. So I've got to remember it was the cold season, and so it's very practical to wear both robes. It can be cold in the morning. So now, by the 7th of January, we visited Ajahn Nyana Damo's monastery, Wat Ratanawan, which is a very splendid place indeed. My memory of the vast sala, my impression of the sala and the grandeur of the buildings, I tend to think of them as Japanese style. The sala, I think it was even more lofty than this temple, maybe just a little bit more, and the pillars I wonder if I'm exaggerating, but I think they were really long, almost from this floor, I think, all the way up to the ceiling, maybe. Massive wooden pillars. Just to give you an idea of the scale, the height of the roofs. And another feature of Wat Ratanavan Monastery was the lakes. There were some artificial lakes made, and there were a few splendid lawns where a flock, or I don't know what you call a gathering of peacocks, a bevy or flocks of peacocks enjoyed the privilege of strutting around. In fact, considering the wildness of the place, I'm surprised they hadn't been eaten, because the monastery is set on the edge of a national reserve. So the sight of peacocks leisurely strolling around, for me, also lent the perception and sanya of a Japanese palace. So it was here I had the privilege to connect and meet with Ajahn Sumedho again, Rinpo Sumedho, and I spent a few afternoons exchanging notes. We didn't spend so much time recollecting memories, past memories, but we did our utmost to stay in the present. So that was a very enjoyable experience for me to connect again with Rinpo. From Ratanavan, then we went down to Bangkok for the... That's not right. Here we are. Can I have a bit more light? I need to consult my notes. Now, from Wat Ratanavan, then we went for a week down at Ajahn Supot's place. That's right. Now this is the monastery that Ajahn Ratanavano has spent some time with. And so he'd already developed his own regular Pindapat routes. And so this was all familiar territory to him. So he was seeking to revive the Pindapat. We made an effort a few mornings, but I'm afraid all doors, apart from one or two occasional supporters who recognized us on the street, most doors seemed closed to us. So it's a sign that Ajahn Ratanavan has been away so long. But there were one or two who expressed their appreciation. Said, "Oh, Ajahn, you're back. That's very nice." Now, Ajahn Suphot's practice is that he tends to emphasize qualities like developing metta, well-being for oneself and others. And then his other practice is finishing his temple, which I think has been going on for the past 15 years. He's got a regular practice of working, developing a very ornate, artistic plaster and art finish to the interior of his temple. And there was this massive scaffolding structure in the center of the floor. And a bit like, was it Leonardo da Vinci, sort of working on the ceiling, or?
Michelangelo.
Was it? Michelangelo. He was steadfastly having buckets of plaster sort of on pulleys taken up. And he and his few helpers were painstakingly working on every inch of the interior. Now, while I was there, I did hear of some monastics who were mildly exasperated at the sort of the insistence on giving such attention to each square inch of the interior. Well, you know, why don't we just plaster it and paint it and be done with it? Just get it finished. But I sense that Ajahn Suphot, he's got no interest in finishing. And because, so, you know, it's like, well, there won't be much to do, you know, if you finish it. The work is the practice. Once you finish the temple, you know, the only other thing to be doing is sweeping the paths. Actually, I did get that impression that on the whole, you know, once the temple's built, the food sala's there, if there are sufficient toilet facilities, for example, once all the basic facilities are provided in a monastery, then all there is left to do is to sweep the paths on a regular basis. So, in essence, you know, life can be much simpler in a warm climate like Thailand. So, for those of you, you know, who are planning on going to Thailand, then 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that's usually the regular spot for getting out of your kuti and picking up a broom and sweeping around the monastery. It's not just a matter of making the place looking nice and presentable. There are very practical reasons for keeping the paths swept. Also to keep the area around living quarters swept. Is it? So to discourage ants, from making the way into your kuti or nesting nearby, to keep the paths clear so you can be sure you're not going to tread on a snake. So, you know, even though the Ratanawan, for example, Wat Ratanawan was on the edge of a national reserve, and so potentially there were there was plenty of wildlife that could come into the monastery and be a hazard to its occupants, but they had very good wide concrete driveways, so that gave me a greater sense of confidence for walking around and enjoying the wildness of the forest. Also, in the streams, in the bottom of the valley, I thought I encountered a crocodile, but I was told I was quite safe. It was actually a water monitor. And they tend to run away from you rather than attack you. So water monitors are seen to be quite common in Thailand. I saw two at Ajahn Lumpo Sopon's monastery, quite large, but it's only fish they're interested in. So from Ajahn Sopon's place, then well, at some stage, at the end of January, yes, at the end of January, the Western monks travelled down from Wat Phananachat, travelled about 700 kilometres, I think, in one day, down to Bangkok. There was a formal ceremony to acknowledge the life of Somdet Buddhajan, and so we had a very impressive gathering and a tour of the ancient Dharma Hall, or was it the boat? The shrine room at Bawon We Wake. And then a very formal gathering of the representatives in the chapel, which is normally in a chapel which is normally reserved for royalty, where the royal sponsored monks were, the most select monks were chanting the Abhidhamma chants and also the Panksakula chants and dedicating the merits to Somdet Buddhajan. So my experience actually was one of feeling quite overawed with like coming to the center of Thailand, connecting with tradition. And I must say that those royal sponsored monasteries, they are very well kept. So all the artwork on the interior and outside are immaculately maintained. You'd find very, very little to fault with the architecture or the decoration. Everything is really kept in tip-top condition. So I have this memory of just being overawed at the scale of the gatherings and the meetings, and also wondering if I was doing the right thing, sitting down at the right time, or paying respects to the right monks, so I was paying close attention to what Ajahn Ratanamana was doing, and making myself available to any prompts of if I'm sitting in the wrong place, or to move and get up and move. One of the features of my whole trip actually has been, I have to pay attention to what's happening in the moment, because when there's a large number of monks, sometimes you have to relate to your immediate environment as part of a crowd. Sometimes it's appropriate to respond to the situation as a junior monk. And then sometimes conditions dictate that you have to behave as the senior monk. I found that quite an exercise in attentiveness. Because you have to be alert to the changing conditions. And, sometimes I didn't get it right. I remember going to one monastery where some of us were invited to give talks to a gathering of lay people who'd come together for a few days of practice. I think this was down at Phetchaburi. And at first we were invited to this reception room where the monks could recover from their journey and get ready for the talks. And so then when we travel, the monks wear a robe over both shoulders. So when you come to a monastery, the custom, the practice is to readjust your robe so you have a bare shoulder. And because I was unaccustomed to this new robe that I'd been given, before I went to Thailand, I wore a very heavy robe, but in a hot climate, it's suitable to wear a much thinner one. I've been given this much thinner robe. And only the tags were very fiddly. They were very tiny and incredibly tight. We've got a system of closing and opening the robes. There were a few awkward moments where I felt really foolish. I was just saying to Ajahn Ratanamana, I can't get out. I can't get out. So I must have, what the other monks thought of me, I do not know, but some things you can't prevent. You just have to take it on the chin. But throughout the whole trip, I really took Ajahn Ratanamana as both my guide and also my teacher. You know, even though he's two vassas junior to me, I really found I learned much, not from what he was telling me or that he was intentionally setting out to teach me, but just from his patient attending to what needs doing and just prompting me to do the suitable thing, reminding me, these junior monks want to pay respects, or now's the time to pay respects to the senior monk. I didn't mind that. I was very happy that at least someone knew what should be happening. I didn't mind being told or prompted. And so it was a very I felt it was very healthy and a cooperative relationship that we'd had, and I was very grateful that. So over those 3 months, I'd felt I'd learned much about the about more about Buddhist culture and how things are done in Thailand just by paying attention to how Ajahn Ratnawano guided me and responded to the changing circumstances. Those of you who know me a little, the monks here, you know, I've been the guest, the lodgings monk for the Sangha for a few years, and you know, I can have very strong opinions about how a kuti should be built, and you know, at least the door should be able to open and close properly, and things like that. I had to suspend, you know, the application of my ideas about how things should be during my time in Thailand. And that was a very good exercise for me. And at one place I arrived, and I could see there was a new kuti, you know, just uphill from the sala, from the main hall. Spanking new kuti. Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Clear space all the way around. I was shown to the other side, down the hill, and you know, even before I got to the kuti, you could see the stairs were rotting. The kutis are usually raised from the ground. The stairs, they were barely touching the ground. The ants had chewed away the bottoms, and so, and then the platform just in front of the kuti. Well, that was all right, except there were these great big gouges in the ground where the door had obviously scraped every time it was open and closed, probably for the last 20 years. And it was evident to me that the door had been made too large. It was almost half the width of the kuti. So there we are. I was doing my utmost to suspend all judgment, thinking that this must be a test. They're testing me, seeing if I can be content with being with the simplest dwelling. And anyway, the saving grace was my glot. The saving grace for this kuti was it had a hook in the centre of the roof. And so once I set up the glot, I felt, so the glot, it's a mosquito net, and I felt relatively secure. I couldn't close the door so that the mosquitoes could still get through the cracks, but not if I was under this glot, this mosquito net. And so after 2 or 3 nights saying this kuti, which I noticed seemed to be particularly energetic at night. There was something strange about the ground and possibly even the trees around it. And I wasn't disturbed. I wasn't upset by this. I was just quite intrigued, very interested, what these strange but very supportive, I felt beneficial energies were. And, you know, after the first 2 or 3 days, I think the other monks could sense I was practicing contentment with my kuti. I didn't know any Thai words to complain, you see. But anyway, the abbot happened to say it one tea time. He said, So, how is it living in your kuti. Oh yes, very good, very good. There's something very special about that kuti. So, and then he started talking about these strange but beneficial vitalities or energies that seem to be manifest in that part of the monastery. So I felt reassured to have like an independent source verifying my intuitions, if you like. So it felt very good to be meditating at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And of course, one of the other reasons why meditating at night is so beneficial, it's much, in Thailand, it's much cooler. It can be, meditating in the heat, it can be quite challenging. One has to cope with restlessness or discomfort of the body, just coping with the heat. So I found that very encouraging, I felt I was really connecting with the energy of the land and nature. And I also found that the walking meditation allowed me to sort of experience an extraordinary centeredness in the body. So it's like it's a gentle sort of concentration in the body. It was very easeful. It wasn't forced. So I really do feel there are beneficial elements, there are beneficial energies that a tropical climate affords. Again, at when I went to Dao Dam, we did an all-night sit. For those of you who know the place, we did an all-night sit at the outer sala. And after a particularly beneficial time of sitting, I happened to comment to the abbot, Ajahn Siripanya. I said, "Oh, I was astounded that I sat here with the monks here for 2.5 hours without moving. It's been years since I've, managed to enjoy such a long sit with relative ease of mind and body and a sense of contentment and uplift and joy." And I wasn't saying that out of, congratulating myself, but saying, "Oh, just saying, this is a good place to be." And again, I was quite pleased when he concurred with me. He said, "Yes, I reckon this is a power spot. So some sort of power spot, something about the land and the energy of the very wild forest there." Some of the evenings we sat outside, myself and Ajahn Ratanavana, we sat outside the outer sala enjoying the view of the forest just stretching off all the way over to the horizon. And as the day was closing, the light was fading. And so with this appreciation of the vastness of the wild forest that stretches over to Burma. Well, Burma is only 2 or 3 kilometers away. With this amazing view of the wildness, the forest. You know, I didn't want to spoil my appreciation of the vastness and the stillness that allowed me to experience, that stillness of mind. I didn't want to disturb or colour that by adding on any recollection of the past or expressing my opinions about other monasteries or how other people practice. This moment of just sitting and experiencing the vastness, the emptiness of the forest reminded me of there was a sutta which talks about varying degrees of emptiness, and the perception of forest is said to be the first. If I've got this wrong, I invite you to come and correct me after the talk, but I seem to recall that Ajahn Buddhadasa talks about varying levels of emptiness, and the perception of forest is said to be the first level. And I've tried to understand what it means in the sutta when it says perception of forest is one of the opportunities to experience stillness and emptiness of mind. Because it says in the sutta, this is where perception of town, perception of monastery, perception of other people can cease, and there's just the being with the wildness, the perception of the forest, or not even the perception, but the direct experience of the forest. It's devoid. One is just experiencing the immediate contact with nature, which for me is very conducive to ending the tendency to proliferate, just an appreciation of the natural world, the forces of nature, to experience like an energy of a tree or the energy of the land, for example, to feel connected with something larger than oneself. That for me, it's an opportunity to allow the thinking mind to cease and to experience stillness. So before I went to Thailand, the nearest I could come to a perception of forest was, you know, our wood across the road. And for years, you know, I tried to get away from all the problems that I created over here because there was so much going on. I didn't know how to manage it. I thought, well, if I just go across the road, perception of forest, just didn't work, you know. Of course, you know, you need scale. There we are. That's what Thailand can provide. And so now I know what perception of forest really is. And, you know, even if that was the only treasure that I took back with me, then that would be worthwhile. So time's passing. I did say at the beginning that, well, how much did you want to hear? How much time do we have? There really were many other treasures and good things, gems that came up during my time, my tour around Thailand, but one of the most important aspects of my trip really was actually making the connections to the abbots of the monastery in Buriram. The name I can't pronounce. I've written it down. Actually, in English, it means Thai, something, Bhavana, monastery at Buriram, Thai developed practitioners, the equivalent of that anyway. And that was Ajahn Chittakorn's monastery. It's the same monastery that Ajahn Hasakorn stays at. And he should be coming to be with us in 2 weeks or so. And even though that monastery, it's set in the middle of a working quarry, even though, you know, once a week or so, you'll have this massive explosion taking place where the rocks are broken up, and it's still a place I'd like to go back to, and to enjoy the benefit of the extraordinary supportive vitality of the trees and the ground. Also, I was encouraged to consider going back for a year, because it's very easy to form an impression of a place because you think, oh, you've been there 2 weeks, so you know what the place looks, the place is like. But of course, the seasons change very dramatically in Thailand. It's one thing to know the cold season, a monastery in the cold season. It's very different in the hot season. When there's no water around, it can be very testing, even for Thai monks, to put up with the extreme climate. And then again, the rainy season. Some parts become very flooded. At Lumphor Sopon's monastery, one of the things I noticed around between the monks' kutis was just how much lumber and timber and litter and generally sort of strange bits of rubbish just seem to accumulate. And of course, at first one makes an effort not to pay attention, but and then before I left, you know, I was offering to say, well, I really like to come back and, you know, help you keep your monastery a bit tidier. And so they said, oh, what do you mean? Said, well, I mean, what's all this stuff, you know, lying around? And, I do recall that Ajahn Jayanto has told me it's normal in Thai monasteries. But anyway, I found myself really wanting to come back and say, come back to the monastery, and I'd really like to help you get all this rubbish out of the way. And thereupon he turned around and pointed to the marks on the walls. And these were chalk marks, 2009 and 2010. Of course, in England, we had this custom of, you know, marking how fast children grow. So I thought, oh, I didn't quite understand what he was saying. Well, yeah. And then it was explained to me. He says, well, no. Those marks are where the water level of was the water level of 2009 and 2010. And there were also a display of photographs of showing you how the monks needed boats to get from their kutis to the Dana hall. So to really know what it's like to reside in a monastery, you need to spend a year. That was the suggestion. How much water floods Thailand is dictated by what happens in China. Apparently the dams, whoever's operating the dams up there. The rain, there's the rain, but there's also the dams being controlled further upstream. There was much and many other little anecdotes I could tell you. I'm happy to share these with you at some other time, maybe in a more informal situation. But just to close this, round off this talk, I'd like to touch on just one or two other hints and suggestions that were dropped into my consciousness that made me realize that Ajahn Suphat and Lumpur Sopon really did want me to go back. When a senior monk says to you, we've already got a 50-acre forest monastery called Gandasila Monastery that I'd like you to come and reside at. You know? And then Ajahn Suphat was saying, oh, he's got a cave he'd like me to go and live in, 60 kilometres away from Karat. And so these were hints, but I sensed that these were just very, very skillfully placed, like seeds that drop in my consciousness that I have to say are growing in the dark, but nevertheless they're growing. So having made those contacts, I feel it could be beneficial, not just for myself, but possibly for others later. So so I see myself moving towards a greater appreciation and making better contacts with Thai customs and culture. So I'm going to leave that with you now. I've just made an effort to share a few benefits of my time away. I've still got 3,000 pictures to sort through. Ajahn Ratnawana has steadfastly been taking about 60 pictures a day. The only downside is they had to be sorted out later. All right, so I'm going to leave you now to sitting until midnight.